I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There's a lot going on in Kansas City these days. A new airport terminal is in the works. City Council is ironing out the particulars of a convention hotel. Prospects for a downtown YMCA are looking pretty good. And despite a disappointing vote in August, officials still want to expand streetcar service to Riverfront Park. Today we'll find out how they plan to pay for it, and we'll get a roundup of the development stories that need to be on your radar. Then we'll get to know the music of Spanish Harlem Orchestra and the musical director who's bringing a Latin-flavored Christmas to town this weekend. Bill Brownlee closes us out with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Lots going on downtown these days on the development front. Here's one big project that's in the works, an extension of the streetcar from the River Market down to the river. Another big project, the Downtown Convention Hotel, that appears to finally be close to a groundbreaking. So much to talk about. With us, Michael Collins is president and CEO of Port KC, which is a key player in Kansas City development. Michael, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Collison is the editor of City Scene KC. That's a hyper-local online news source that focuses on downtown Kansas City. You can find it at cityscenekc.com. Kevin, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Michael, tell us why you want to extend the streetcar to the riverfront. This is a $32 million project. Why is that kind of money worth it?
Well, it's worth it. First and foremost is our overall strategic objective is to get everyone in the Kansas City region connected to the riverfront. It's where Kansas City started, and we wanted to make sure that everyone had an opportunity to get there. So it wasn't that if we build a $32 million streetcar extension, everyone's going to come. We actually had to do another couple of development opportunities to actually entice people to be there.
I was going to say, no one's been paying attention to the riverfront in a long time, but it's changing, right? Tell us what's going on.
Yes, it's absolutely changing. Right now, scheduled for April, phase one of our first development of 410 units for multifamily housing is scheduled to open. The second phase of that, the other 200 plus units, will be ready to go in the summer. So already we have 410 units to go, and stay tuned in 2018 for hopefully more announcements.
So what is this extension? How is it going to be funded, Michael?
Well, a lot of it's going to be funded. First and foremost, it's not going to be funded with taxpayer dollars. Port KC, the Port Authority, is not funded through taxpayer dollars. We're actually funded through leases, through development agreements and development fees that we generate over the course of the year, or through any other leases that we have. So we generate those with the developable land at Berkeley Riverfront. So we will create some of that. We have what's called a Port Improvement District. That is an overlay for sales and use tax, but only for Berkeley Riverfront development.
How far is it from the River Market to the riverfront? How long of an extension are we talking about here?
Well, from the current extension, which is where, or the current line at 3rd and Grand is where it really terminates, you're talking about just a little over about a mile.
I didn't even know it was that far.
Yeah.
That's just interesting. Kevin Collison, how big of a deal is this? Put this project in context for us. Extending the streetcar, how big of a difference will it make?
Well, the efforts to get our riverfront redeveloped go back a long time. There's been substantial money spent over the past 10, 20 years to clean it up, to get it ready for redevelopment. It's always been viewed as a great asset for the community. So to bring the streetcar down there would certainly help bolster the argument that this is an easy place to get to. It's a fun place for people to go, both to live, work, and play. And I might add also that it is also one of the largest development sites available downtown. And one interesting thing I learned a couple of weeks ago, that the riverfront Berkeley area is the only downtown site that was pitched to Amazon as a potential location for its headquarters complex, simply because there's a lot of land down there. So if you bring a streetcar down there, it obviously will make it a far, far better connected section of our downtown area to the remainder of downtown. And then obviously if it extends ultimately to UMKC, You could hop on a streetcar right where we're sitting now and be on the riverfront within 20 minutes.
What's now in between the River Market and the riverfront? What's there?
Well, it's basically, and Michael can correct me, but I mean, right now there's some really nice recreational trails down there. There's the park. There's this new apartment project that he referred to. And essentially, one of the biggest components of it and one of the more fascinating aspects of this whole proposal is you've got the Grand Avenue Viaduct or Grand Boulevard Viaduct. I'm not sure if it's an avenue or boulevard down there. But anyway, it's this big chunk of concrete that right now is just carrying cars back and forth and not all that many of them. And part of this proposal calls for the streetcar to not only use the viaduct, but also to create new trail along that viaduct for bicyclists and pedestrians, which again helps to connect the riverfront with the River Market.
Michael Collins with Port KC, how contingent is this project on getting money from the federal government?
Well, we've built a few scenarios, financial scenarios. First being, obviously, we would love to be able to go after and we'll secure Tiger funding.
Saying, Tiger grants always the grant you hear about.
Absolutely. But we built it based upon a cost share match of not your normalized 80-20, where a federal government gives you 80%, you come up with 20%. We actually did more of a almost a 50-50 share, and that was our first financial cost analysis. We have other subsequent cost analysis that we're building out if we are not successful with the Tiger Grant application.
So bottom line is this project is not contingent on federal funding?
No, it's not contingent upon federal funding. It creates more challenges if we do not receive federal funding. But, you know, in a world where federal funding is already so scarce, it wouldn't behoove us to really rely on that. So we knew while we would really love to have that federal funding, we really needed to come up with other realistic plans to try to create cost share with other types of funds, may it be fee simple sale or leases of our current property.
So if this all comes together, how soon might construction begin?
Well, if we are right now, we're in stage two of the kind of a four stage due diligence before we say we're ready to go to construction. And after that is done, if we get to stage four, you're really talking about really just about a 2-year time frame. It's really a short time frame to extend. Number one, because of the carry load of the cars that go by at the Grand Avenue Viaduct, we already have the deadweight load needed to support the infrastructure needed for the streetcar.
Why wasn't this part of the original streetcar plan, the 2.2-mile route?
Well, we had talked about it, and it's simply we weren't ready. And we weren't ready because we were still at that time, still going with our master plan of really trying to create a concept that would work for Berkeley Riverfront, as well as what could we do to gradually gravitate towards, number one, building density of people understanding about Berkeley Riverfront and what we're trying to sell so it makes sense. So we weren't really trying to start off with the streetcar because it really, economically and development-wise, it really didn't make sense to start that way. We wanted to illustrate that we could develop there and that a streetcar would actually help really catapult that for faster development in the future.
I was going to say, you guys obviously feel strongly that this development with the streetcar brings the riverfront and Berkeley Park sort of into the mainstream life of Kansas City.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've wanted this to be a area where people park their cars and don't utilize their cars to go in and out for working throughout the day or going to eat, but always have that available transportation to them at any given point.
Now, Michael, tell us a little bit about Port KC, because it is one of those underground kind of organizations in town that carries a lot of weight that a lot of people don't know about.
Right. You know, across the country, people laugh sometimes when I say we're actually not that really different than Port Authority in New York, New Jersey. It's really kind of how you're set up. Port KC, or the Kansas City Port Authority, we're a political subdivision of the state of Missouri. We work in concert with the city very closely. The mayor appoints our board of commissioners. And after that, a lot of our financial audits and our annual reports are actually provided and given to the state of Missouri and through Missouri Department of Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
We're also funded through our development leases. As some people know, we still carry quite a bit of property at the old Richards Kabauer Airport. So we have about 600,000 square feet currently under management and leased through us. Obviously, development finance, we've done quite a few development finance finance deals across the city.
And you do what? What's the point, the purpose of Port KC?
The purpose of Port KC is really to first focus on transportation. Secondly, focus on commerce and focus on development. Obviously, we've gravitated towards the riverfront because a lot of that was already adopted prior to us, prior to me coming on board and my new team. But our delineated area per se is the entire city of Kansas City, Missouri, or Kansas City proper. But we focus on transportation, commerce, and development.
Okay. Kevin, again, you've covered groups like this for a long time. This group has a significant portfolio, as Michael is saying, and a lot of clout.
They do, and they have some very effective incentives that can help get development going. One of their biggest recent projects was not on the riverfront. It was the redevelopment of the Corrigan Station office building, which is being described as the largest new office project downtown in 25-plus years. It was the renovation of a historic building on Walnut Street. And one thing I might add is that also with the streetcar, if it is to come down to the riverfront, I know from reading the Tiger Grant application that the Port KC people and others believe that would attract a far more intensive development than otherwise might take place, simply because, you know, you don't have to have as much room for parking when you've got that kind of asset bringing people back and forth. And therefore, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it's a significant increase in the value of the property down there and the amount of development that could occur if the streetcar was to come down.
So how many units, when it's all done, Michael, do you expect to have down there?
So I'll give you streetcar and non-streetcar. Non-streetcar currently today is what we're focused on, and we're already preparing for 1,500 units. With a streetcar being added, you're talking 2,000-plus units.
No kidding.
Yes.
And these are, cost of the units will be what?
Do you know? It all varies upon the type of development that we'll have. It also varies on the construction costs that are out there. The Union project is going to be market rate. I'm still getting those numbers just right now, so I'm not going to tell you what they are per square foot. That's kind of how I relay those to you. But we're also looking at different price points in the future. We're not looking at just market rate. We're looking at other price points that will actually allow everyone to enjoy the riverfront. That's really what it's all about.
Even low income folks.
We'll look at all types. What we have to be provided an interest for it, because Port KC, we're not actually building the vertical. We're more than happy to talk to anyone. Mostly we're talking to out of town developers because they love Kansas City and they love putting investment here.
What are the views like down there?
The views are really good. Actually, we're taking a tour. Actually, my staff is taking a tour right now, and I'm missing it, but. On one of the apartments views, you'll see the Missouri River. You'll see the Kitbon Bridge. You'll see Heart of America Bridge. And then you'll see the dynamic skyline view of downtown Kansas City. So if you have one view that your apartment is from the southwest side of the apartments, you'll wake up looking at the downtown skyline, and you'll have dinner looking at the Bond Bridge and the river.
Not too bad. Paula from Parkview writes us this question. Will they have any maintenance-provided properties for baby boomers wanting to downsize?
Well, actually, you know, very interesting. The market for apartments and multifamily housing is significantly already geared towards baby boomers and millennials. What we've learned is baby boomers like to live with their children's friends, but not necessarily their children. And so
there's a talk show for you. I could go on about that for a while. Yeah.
So we're already building a lot of amenities that are attractive for everyone. One thing we've learned is that the ability of what walkability means. Walkability to a millennial means I can go somewhere at any point in time and try new things. Walkability for a baby boomer is, well, I know I want to walk to my grocery store at a specific time. I know where I can go and grab my dinner. I know where I can go and entertain my guests when they come in, and that's walkability. So we've been addressing that. Thanks for the question. We've been addressing that already and making sure that we have all of the amenities, mainly really suburban-style amenities in an urban setting.
Kevin Collison, this has got you and Kathy's name written all over. I can see you guys moving down.
We're taking applications.
I definitely would
Kevin.
Like to take a look at a place like that. And again, you know, the streetcar, if you're a boomer and you're looking for amenities, you know, you can hop on that streetcar and be able to get to anything in the River Market or the Central Business District or the Crossroads for dinner, for shopping at Costantino's grocery store, whatever. It does kind of make it a little easier to do more residential because some of the other amenities are available. And also, we can't discount the fact, again, the only location in downtown Kansas City being pitched to Amazon is the riverfront. So it's not just a residential area. There is certainly a lot of prospects. In fact, a couple of the bigger proposals over the past 10 years were more office-oriented, and this residential project is actually going up. But at one point, when the General Services Administration, the federal government, was thinking about doing a downtown office building, there was a real strong effort by the port to get the GSA to go down there. Now, that project went away. But again, it's always been touted as a mixed-use area, not just residential.
You know, there was this vote in August in Kansas City, a citywide vote seen as a setback for streetcar expansion, basically saying that if you want to expand the streetcar, you got to have a citywide backing for it. Does that vote impact what you want to do?
Well, one of the things we focused on is, you know, we haven't really focused on the expansion. While we'd love to see expansion go further south,
but this is expansion.
This is an extension of the current TDD.
An extension of
it's
the current
extension,
TDD.
Not an expansion. So the one of the components.
Thank you, Dr. Lawyer. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
One of the current components is a lot of people don't know this is actually Port KC was a partner with the city of Kansas City in creating the first streetcar TDD. So we are part of the original Transportation Development District, and actually part of Berkeley Riverfront, mainly Riverfront West, is actually already within the TDD. So we've looked at it, as well as some people may or may not know, port authorities in the state of Missouri are actually identified as local transportation authorities. So we actually have the ability to continue to move forward with many and certain transportation type projects without being tacked on to the expansion concept and discussion. But that's something that obviously we continue to look at, of course, because one thing that helps us in pursuing our strategic objective of having the extension there is further expanding so that we have more riders actually enjoying the riverfront and seeing what it's like for them.
Given your work in transit, do you anticipate any problems extending the streetcar line out to UMKC?
I really can't answer that. I really hope not. I really think the numbers are there that really support an effort of moving people. I think.
Well, I get that, but the legal questions now in the wake of that vote have raised questions in some people's minds.
They have raised questions. I have an MBA degree and not a law degree, so I'll stay away from
those.
Talking
like a lawyer here today, you know.
I really hope that it becomes easier in the process in the very near future to allow this to occur.
You know, you're leaving Port KC in January, Michael, to take a new position at J.E. Dunn. How is this going to affect the work that Port KC does and the streetcar project we're discussing here at all?
No, it's not. We've built a great team that's led by great vice presidents at at Port KC. We've been built as a team and not as a unit of one. So while things will change when I leave, obviously some priorities may change. But what's more important is I have a great team at Port KC, which unfortunately will not be my team at the end of this month. And they know the drive. They're the ones that have been creating these projects with me from day one. And so they have a complete understanding of what it takes to move forward. So actually, I'm really excited to see what they're going to do without me.
Michael Collins, again, president and CEO of Port KC, the outgoing president. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for your time.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
We have Kevin just for a few more minutes here. I wanted to ask you about some other developments going on that you write about on City Scene KC, Kevin. Maybe the biggest piece of news in recent days has to do with the Downtown Convention Hotel, which is finally on the brink of a groundbreaking here. Or is it? Because Councilwoman Heather Hall was on the show yesterday saying she still wants some questions answered about financing here.
Well, from what I know, all the approvals have been obtained from the development agencies. The city council approved this deal 2 years ago. So as I understand, what the councilwoman and a couple of her colleagues want is just some more clarification on the financing.
Not to derail the project necessarily.
Well, but here's where the twist is. I mean, you know, all these development agencies approved the deal last week. However, the developer now has to go out into the bond market and try to sell $110 million in municipal in bonds to help finance this project. And you know, we've got a Congress right now that's considering sweeping changes to how the federal tax law works, which could affect bonding and other types of subjects. The mayor has brought that up as being a question mark surrounding the financing of the airport. So the last thing they want is somebody to say, well, we're going to hold back our $35 million city contribution until we get these questions answered, which, again, you know, I know the finance department at City Hall thought this was a good deal. The LCRA, the bond council, Lowe's, which is kicking in $60 million, thinks this is a good deal. Wells Fargo, which is lending $110 million to this project. What exactly these council members want at this late stage that is worth causing even more question marks about the private bond sale? I don't know. I really don't.
Put this project in context for us again, because you're always so good about that. How big a deal will a new downtown convention hotel be, assuming we proceed here?
Well, you know, first off, and it's something that hasn't really been talked about a lot, it's going to create 400 full-time jobs. And a lot of these are going to be entry-level jobs for people who live close to downtown who can take mass transit to get to those jobs. So it'll be a good source of permanent jobs. It's going to be a source of 1,500 construction jobs. It's a $322 million 24-story project. And then in the big picture, the folks at Lowe's, who are certainly professionals in the field of hotels, believe that this is going to put Kansas City into direct competition with places like Nashville and Indianapolis and Austin, places that we haven't been able to compete with because we haven't just had enough room nights to attract the large conventions. And also, it's being described as a 4-star hotel, which they believe is another extra lure to get more convention business than we have previously.
Do you buy that? Notion that this will put Kansas City on a higher plane when it comes to tourism?
I do, but it puts a lot of burden on Visit KC and the other folks who now have to go out there and sell this community. I mean, you know, I've covered this story, as somebody pointed out, at the LCRA meeting the other day. It's been going on, this discussion, for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of task forces examining this, and there was a lot of folks. And, you know, the big thing is, can they bring in additional business? Because if it turns out to be a hotel that poaches business merely from existing hotels, then we're really not doing all that well. But if we can turn this thing into something that makes Kansas City a more popular place for large conventions that otherwise passed us by, then it's certainly, you know, anytime anybody's in downtown Kansas City and there's a large convention going on, you can tell the energy level is a totally different level. You got lots of people milling around with their little tags over their around their necks, and they're buying food, and they're buying beer, and they're going out on the town. So, you know, it definitely, a lot of it can work if we really take advantage of it.
This hotel will be located basically just down the street from the Kauffman Center, right on 16th Street.
Literally a half a block from the, in fact, it's kitty corner, to be honest with you. It's on the block along Wyandotte, directly across from the Grand Ballroom. It's going to have views from what the architectural renderings from the bar, of beautiful views of our downtown skyline. It'll be a nice connection between downtown and the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts and the Crossroads area, kind of a nice link connecting the two places. And, you know, we've worked at it for a long time in the city. It's been talked about. It's been researched. And now we're on the cusp of finally breaking ground on it. And, again, I personally, from everything I can tell from covering this thing for a long time, it's been properly vetted. And the big thing is, the city from the get-go insisted we don't want our credit to be at risk. We don't want, like a lot of cities like Denver, Dallas, et cetera, they basically finance these convention hotels. St. Louis got into a horrible situation. Well, they have achieved that prime directive from City Hall that no city tech or no city credit is involved.
We're not on the hook
if it starts going south. Then it's up to the developer and the other people who have invested this thing to cover the losses.
A fairly unusual arrangement,
which,
too,
you know, right? And the $60 million from Lowe's and its private partners. Most people tell me that that's a really significant amount of private equity that's going into this deal as well.
You've also been writing about a future downtown YMCA. Where does that stand?
The state of Missouri recently approved the Missouri Economic Development. I can't remember one of those alphabet state tax credit agencies recently approved tax credits that the YMCA believes is all they needed to do to get their financing completed to renovate the old Lyric Theater. And actually, they basically will keep the front third of the Lyric, the facade, but they'll take down the back two-thirds of it and put in a whole new building to create an indoor track, pool, all kinds of things. Plus, it's going to be a lot of health programs. So it seems to be very close to reality. It's been something, again, that the downtown council and has been pushing for a long time. Phil Kirk, who was this very highly respected head of DST Realty, put his heart and soul into this thing. He's passed away a couple of years ago. But it's something that will take the Lyric, which has been sitting empty ever since the Kauffman Center opened up because it lost its major tenants, and put it back into a much more vibrant hub in that corner or that central part of downtown.
You get a sense that the downtown is really filling in. There aren't nearly as many gaps, if you will, than there was even a few years ago. The Lyric Opera being converted to a Y is just one more example of that.
Very true. Very true. I mean, in fact, we are getting to the point where we're almost out of older office buildings that have been rehabbed in downtown Kansas City. There's a couple of large ones left, but for the most part, many of these properties are now back in action with apartments and other activity going on. So things are definitely looking very encouraging for downtown. And with the hotel, with the YMCA, with some of the other efforts that are going on, you know, I would be safe to say that downtown is in a very good position moving forward.
You know, it's just amazing to me, you know, the transformation of downtown. You know, we've talked many times, you get downtown these days on a Friday or Saturday night, it's humming. And boy, what a rapid transformation this has been in some regards from where the city was even 10 or 15 years ago.
You know, you and I have talked about this. I moved to Kansas City in 2001, and I still remember taking our daughter to the Nutcracker at the Midland. We walked from the Star parking lot there, and we went by broken bottles, dirty bookstores, hot oil massage joints, haunted houses. It just was awful.
Yeah.
And now you go through that same four-block walk, and you've got people living there. You've got a streetcar going by. You've got most of these storefronts restored. The Midland's been overhauled. The Main Street. There's been a lot of there's a lot of great things going on. A lot of things still need to happen. Just was in Chicago last weekend, and man, I'm telling you, talk about a place that's dynamic.
Let's do this, Kevin. We're having trouble reaching Oscar Hernandez with the Grammy-winning Spanish Harlem Orchestra. Can you hang around just for a few minutes? Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Kevin Collison from City Scene KC. We'll talk about the new KCI and the design there, the Buck O'Neill Bridge developments there, Children's Mercy Hospital just announcing plans for a 9-story research tower, and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, what makes for an effective volunteer? It's the season for giving back, but are you doing it in a way that's actually helpful? We'll get some insights. Then a look at the great debate between which Jewish food is the best Jewish food, the latke or the hamantash. Am I saying that right? Hamantash, yeah. I love it when they throw words like that at me. Anyway, I'm sitting here visiting with Kevin Collison from City Scene KC. We're going to talk about some new developments downtown. We're hoping to get Oscar Hernandez with the Spanish Harlem Orchestra with us, that group coming to town this weekend. Tell us about City Scene KC and what you're trying to do there, because this is a brand new venture.
It's a new thing I started last July, Steve, and thanks for asking. It's a labor of love. I mean, I worked at the Star for 13 years. Covering development for the paper. Really, again, a lot of that had to do with the revitalization of downtown. So I've always been a big urban fan. And I left the Star, worked at a couple of places freelancing for the KCUR folks, which is great, and got together last summer, launched this website, cityscenekc.com. And my vision for it is to be the source for all things downtown. I mean, I want to be like the community small town newspaper for downtown Kansas City. So I cover not only development, but I cover new businesses opening up. And it's just so, and it's free, cityscenekc.com. I encourage people to check it out. Love to get your feedback. But it is something that I really enjoy. It's a passion of mine. I love being back into reporting again, talking to people I used to talk to at the Star. And it's a whole new world, and it's really a lot of fun. And I hope people enjoy it, and I hope I'm filling a niche that exists in downtown.
We'll come back sometime soon, and we'll talk about some of these items I just mentioned before the break, development, a design for the new KCI terminal, Children's Mercy Hospital. Sure appreciate you hanging around, Kevin. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
escucha bien cómo el ritmo va, para que puedan bailarlo así.
Now that's the way to put a little sizzle in your holiday. That's the Grammy-winning Spanish Harlem Orchestra, and the good news, they'll be in downtown Saturday night at the Folly Theater. And this group practically reaches into your head and forces you to move, as you can tell. Joining us now is Oscar Hernandez. He's the Grammy-winning musical director and pianist for the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. He joins us now from the studios of Voice Tracks West in Studio City, California. At least I think that's where Oscar is. Oscar, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So good to have you.
Pleasure to spend a few minutes with you and your listeners.
Your sound is described as setting the standard for excellence, for authentic New York-style hardcore salsa, Oscar. How accurate a description is that?
Well, that's pretty accurate. There's been a bunch of other adjectives to describe the band, but that's pretty close. We're really proud, you know, to represent the history and a legacy of this style of music that goes back to the 1940s and 50s, especially in the city of New York, represented by some incredible musicians that were part of that legacy. And here we are, you know, some 50 years later, you know, holding that banner up high and putting them, you know, the music on the pedestal that we feel it merits to be on.
Where does salsa music come from, Oscar?
Well, salsa music is Afro-Cuban based. So it's based from Cuba. The rhythms are based from Cuba, but they developed in their own unique way in the city of New York, in, like I said, in the 50s, with such incredible bands as Machito, Tito Puente,
yes,
Tito Rodriguez, Celia Cruz, Ray Barreto, Eddie Palmieri, on and on. There's so many musicians that are part of the fabric of what that music was. And it was it represents the development of Latino culture in the city of New York during those days. And music was a huge part of what that cultural development was. So
what is salsa music? I mean, what's the typical instrumentation that's needed to make it the right way?
Well, it depends if you're talking about conjunto. Conjunto is a smaller band of two percussionists and two horns, or orchestra, which is usually four to five instrumentalists, or big band. There's also big band representation, which is the same as a jazz big band, four trumpets, five saxes, and four trombones. But orchestra is what we have, which is five horns, is two trumpets, two trombones, and a baritone that doubles on flute, a sax that doubles on flute.
Wow.
That's the sound of Spanish Harlem Orchestra, and it also has three singers and five rhythm players, including piano and bass and three percussionists. So it's pretty much within the realm of what that instrumentation that I just described.
Right. I should point out the Spanish Harlem Orchestra presents Salsa Navidad at 8 Saturday night at the Folly Theater. That's downtown on 12th Street. For tickets, go to follytheater.org. You know, you've played all over the world. Do people in different parts of the world react to salsa in different ways?
Well, we've been blessed, as you say, with Spanish Harlem Orchestra to play all over the world, and such countries as Russia, Australia, Israel, Hong Kong, Japan, just about every country in Europe. And the good thing is that we get pretty much a great reaction. People respond to the excellent. Well, first of all, I have to say, Spanish Harlem Orchestra is one of the finest music ensembles of any style of music that you're going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It's great musicianship, excellent musicians that are steeped in the tradition of what salsa or Latin music is, also steeped in the tradition of jazz and as well, too, because we do a lot of jazz festivals all over the world. But to answer your question, I think I would say that people walk away feeling totally impressed and totally happy and totally elated and totally
because you can't
vibrant.
Sit still, right, Oscar? You're no one's going to sit still in their seats on Saturday night.
No, exactly. At the end of a concert, I mean, we like for it to be a concert setting because we want people to really, I mean, it is dance music at the core of it, but we want people to appreciate, we love the performing arts centers because we want people to appreciate you know, the music from a listening point of view, because you're going to see excellent musicianship. You're going to see the chemistry between the singers and the horns and the rhythm section and the singers. So there's a lot to appreciate: excellent arrangements, excellent musicianship. So we don't want that to be lost on the audience. And sometimes dance a little bit trivializes what
right.
that is.
Is this music as popular and as vital today as it was back in the 50s and 60s?
Well, there's a different dynamic. It's hard to compare. I would say probably no, because it's a whole new generations have passed by, you know, and I think the new generations are so saturated and inundated with so much style of music,
yeah.
you know, all over. And a lot of it is, unfortunately, a lot of it isn't very good, in my estimation. That's my own humble opinion. But the truth of the matter is, I think that people have to go out and seek quality music. And it's important that people go beyond
yeah.
what they're given in terms of commercial music to seek, you know, really good music. And that's where education and information and passing it down, you know, comes in as far as we're concerned. I'm fortunate to do some clinics and workshops at different universities and high schools occasionally. So we like to pass it down to the younger generations in terms of how beautiful this music is.
Let's listen to another track here from the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. This is La Fiesta Empezó, The Party Started.
You got it.
That's the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. They perform at 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Folly Theater. Oscar, how did this group come together?
Well, originally it was the idea of a producer who wasn't a musician, but he was a music producer. And he had gotten a deal with Warner Brothers Records in the year 2000. And he called me up, and I put all the... we discussed the concept. We discussed the songs. He wanted to do songs that had been done before. So we chose what those songs were and did brand new arrangements and went into the studio, recorded it. Warner Brothers dropped the record. They put it on the shelf, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And he sold it to a small company at the end of the year 2001. And it was released and it got nominated for a Grammy. And it gave me what, you know, what I call is, you know, my mission in life. Because
mm-hmm.
I started the band, and we started traveling and started garnering more critical acclaim and started performing to live audiences and taking our music, like I said, now 15 years later. This is our 15th year anniversary.
Wow.
So I'm really proud of the legacy that we've been able to create in those 15 years and the excellence because, you know, we have 4 Grammy nominations and 2 Grammys won. So that speaks to volumes in terms of, you know, the excellence of the music.
I'm visiting with Oscar Hernandez. He's the Grammy-winning musical director for the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. I'm just guessing here, Oscar, that a band like this has to have fun together to be able to play like this.
Well, for sure. I think that, you know, all the musicians, there's 13 of us. We travel, and we're on the same page in terms of, you know, they're all excellent people who have a lot of experience playing with a lot of different people, but we all are clear on the concept and the importance of keeping the legacy of this music alive. And for sure, I think that, you know, we have a great time. Spanish Harlem Orchestra is one of the few bands that still records live.
Hmm.
When we go to the studio, we record live without click tracks.
Wow.
So I think, you know, that represents that you need to have excellent musicians, number one, to be able to do that. And people who have a camaraderie, you know, with sharing, you know, our musical talent together and creating together. So,
you know, your family, Oscar, came to New York from the South Bronx, and the South Bronx from Puerto Rico. Tell me about growing up in the South Bronx back in the 1950s.
Well, the South Bronx, you know, it had an incredibly bad reputation. But for me, it was a happy childhood. I grew up a big family, and we
were the youngest of 11, Oscar. I don't know how you survived that.
Well, we didn't know we were poor, but we had a great time. In a way, I tell people that music saved my life, which I feel it did. you know, I was very fortunate. But we grew up, the South Bronx, for all its bad reputation, was very vibrant in terms of culturally, in terms of musically, in terms of people. You know, I've been to other depressed areas where, you know, for me, there were a lot of worse areas where you feel there's no hope. In the Bronx, at least there was a sense of hope, you know, with a lot of people.
Right.
And there was a lot happening, good and bad. So I'm very proud to have been from there. I'm not there anymore, as you know, but happy and proud to have been, you know, raised in that setting.
I read that you used to sneak into nightclubs when you were a boy and listen to Ray Barretto and Eddie Palmieri. And take us back to one of those nights, because I bet that was just a blast.
Well, I remember at 16 years old, me and a childhood musician, colleague, friend of mine, dear friend, who we grew up together, Easter. It was Easter Sunday, and it was actually, I think it was the first couple of days of April, and there was a huge snowstorm. But nevertheless, they had a place called in the Bronx called the Hunts Point Palace. And they had, like, probably 7 bands for $7 back in those days. So we snuck in. You know, we paid our $7. Nobody knew, because they didn't check IDs in those days. And we just stood in front of that bandstand for, like, 6 hours, you know, listening to everybody. And for me, yeah, that was my training ground, you know. And I was completely absorbed, because it was the music that used to hear from every other window, every other door where I grew up. And it's the music that my older brothers were listening to, and I used to see them getting ready on Friday and Saturdays to go out dancing. And New York was extremely dynamic and extremely vibrant. They had anywhere from 30 to 40 clubs that you could go on any given night in
Wow.
New York City, especially on the weekend.
That's Oscar Hernandez. He's the Grammy-winning musical director and pianist for the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. They'll be at the Folly Theater on Saturday night. Oscar, what a pleasure to have you. We'll look forward to seeing you on Saturday, okay?
Well, thank you, my friend, and peace and blessings to you and your listeners. And, hey, don't miss it. It's not often that Spanish Harlem Orchestra comes into Kansas City, you know, and I could probably count the times on one finger the bands of this, you know, type of music are going to be there. So whatever you do, come out, you'll have a great time. And that's the one thing I guarantee. So don't miss it. And thank you again for having me. It's my pleasure.
All the best, Oscar. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's Wednesday, which means KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, good to have you.
Thanks. I intend to be at the Folly Theater on Saturday night.
Sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it?
No doubt about it.
You want to talk about not the Spanish Harlem Orchestra, but a group called the Match Sellers. Tell us about them.
Well, just think of the opposite of the Spanish Harlem Orchestra, and you're almost there.
Almost there.
The Match Sellers are an old-timey folk duo consisting of a woman who's based here in Kansas City and a man who's from Indiana.
Let's listen to the Match Sellers.
Take off my shoes.
there's absolutely no hope for me, Bill, because I like the Spanish Harlem Orchestra and I like the Match Sellers as well. That sounds pretty good.
We're both weirdos that way, Steve. Yeah.
What catches your ear here about them, Bill?
Well, you know, this is just raw, organic music.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not the least bit processed. But my favorite aspect of the Match Sellers is that they're really funny.
Huh.
This is a song about passing a bottle at a folk or bluegrass festival late at night around a campfire. You know, that's why the song is titled Dirt and Beard Hair. That's what the whiskey tastes like after it's passed around the campfire a few times at these events. You know, and that's funny, and it's a reality at those events where everyone kind of smells bad.
Who are these guys?
Well, there's Andrew Morris, who plays guitar and sings, and Julie Bates, who's a fiddler, and the woman who's singing here. And that's it. It's just the two of them, and their shows, and they have two coming up here, are fun in that not only are the songs amusing like this, but their between-song banter is exceptionally funny.
They really know how to work it.
Yeah, they've clearly studied old episodes of Hee Haw and, you know, 1950s radio shots from the Grand Ole Opry. They are in character, and it works.
Well, speaking of humor, just for the record, the chorus of this song goes, "Oh, find me a place where guitars strum all night and the whiskey smells like dirt and beard hair."
That's
there
right.
There you go. Whatever
sounds
that is.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
I didn't know beard had a smell. But that's the Match Sellers. They'll be where this weekend, Bill?
They'll be Sunday afternoon at the Stockyards Brewing Company, and they're playing Tuesday at Record Bar in a fundraising show called Cover Me KC, in which dozens of folk musicians cover one another's songs.
Again, that's the Match Sellers, that track, Dirt and Beard Hair. Bill Brownlee talking about this group in this week's Local Listen. Thanks so much, Bill. Always appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, it's the season for giving back. We'll get insight on how to be an effective volunteer during the holidays and a conversation about which Jewish holiday comfort food reigns supreme. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.